Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Our Wednesday weekday guest, Mariam Jacobs, is back with us today to discuss her views on mass incarceration, the need for changes in the courts and penal system in the United States, and other issues about some of these things that are going on within the penal system. The least costly and transparent solution to prison reform would be to replace prisons with long-term residential treatment facilities with professionals and experienced psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health counselors and substance abuse counselors, medical doctors, nurses, occupational, physical therapists, and educational and vocational components to be included. Mariam Jacobs is a psychosocial therapist, and she is in the process of nearing the end of her published book that she will be getting out there so that all of you, including myself and others, will be able to learn something from, to be able to read it and understand some of the things that go on in this country. So I want to once again, Mariam, are you on with us?
Yes, Leona, I am on with you.
I once again want to introduce Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands, who will be speaking now. And Mariam, we welcome you once again, as always, for your intelligent comment, understanding of the criminal justice system and the damaging effects of the incarcerated men and women throughout the world, especially throughout this country. Thank you for being on with us. Please introduce yourself again.
Well, I am Mariam. I come from the Netherlands. I work as a psychosocial therapist and philosopher with incarcerated people here in the Netherlands. In my treatment, I meet the person, the human being behind crime. I also study philosophy, and I'm writing a book about how the prison system in the United States functions and what is happening behind the surface, behind what we see. So I'm finding answers to questions, for instance, like how is it possible that we still use solitary confinement while in the 50s already it had been proven to be a form of torture? Why is there restricting housing while we know it's only harming people? Why do we see written in the law that it's about rehabilitation while everybody knows that there is no rehabilitation in the prison system? And how is it possible that these things can happen while there is a law that says the opposite? So to get answers to these questions, I'm digging deeper into the material, and there is from politics, from economy, but I try to connect the wires, and what I see is that the puzzle is going to be complete, and I describe the picture that I see from the puzzle in my book.
I'm looking forward to that book. It's been underway for some time, and Mariam, I know that there are many of us who write books, many people have written books, but to do the research you have done has been overwhelming, I'm sure.
Yes, it is very heavy. I have been researching on this topic for about 2 years. I'm not writing since 2 years, but I started my research about 2 years ago because I don't understand that there is a system like this in a democracy. You know, I can understand when there is a system like this in poor countries or totalitarian regimes, but not in a democracy. And so 2 years ago, I already started thinking about it, reading about it. 1.5 years ago, I visited a prison in Florida, and I experienced for myself the sphere of suppression, of power. It made me feel guilty. You know, I was a visitor in a visiting room, but being in that surrounding, it made me feel guilty. So this has nothing to do with crimes that have been committed. This has to do with the way this system is arranged and who benefit from it. And it's amazing. And at the same time, it doesn't amaze me anymore because I get deeper answers to the way politics plays with laws and the way economy is involved, but also the view that society has on people who have committed a crime and how these sentiments in society are used to manipulate people. So there is a lot going on, and I hope that I can be able to contribute, even if it's only a little bit, to just to awareness. So I also write from a neutral point, and I just describe what is going on. And I do believe that when we want to break down these walls, then we first have to examine how these walls are built up. So otherwise we don't know what we are doing. We first have to know exactly who is responsible in a juridical way, you know, in an official way, how does moral responsibility play a role. All these issues are very important to connect to each other to get a complete picture, and then we can understand what kind of prisoners are we dealing with, what they go through in the system, and then we can apply programs to these people. But first we have to know, what is this puzzle, what is this picture, what is this system in depth?
We had a caller last time you were on who was very interested in what you had been talking about, and I actually invited her to come on the show. We have someone on with us now. I don't know if it is her, but could you please state your name? No, this may be a caller that's calling in just to listen to the show. But the individual that had on Facebook had been listening, and she was very interested in what you were talking about. And I guess she also had a loved one inside who was going through an awful lot. And she was she was a warrior in fighting for him. But I want to let this listener know, if they want to at any time step in and say something, please feel free to do so. We have a lot of people in this country who see the injustices going on, who have comments to say, but they're too afraid to speak out. I want to encourage people not to be afraid to speak out, because that's what advocates are all about. That's what family members or friends of the incarcerated are all about. If you see someone that's having difficulties in the prisons, or someone that is wrongfully convicted, whatever the case may be, we're not going to help them if we can't speak out. We can listen to the advice, we can listen to the recommendations, we can listen to the social or psychosocial problems that are in this world today, but unless we actually do something with that knowledge that we acquire from people like Marion Jacobs, psychosocial therapists and others, we're getting all this information, but we're keeping it within ourselves. So again, Marion, I want to thank you for the weeks that you've been coming on every Wednesday, normally at 9 o'clock this week, because she had lectures and other important things to do. We have scheduled it for 2 o'clock our time, which right now is about 8 o'clock your time, isn't it, Marianne?
Yeah, that's right. And today I was in that's why I couldn't be on at 9 o'clock your time. I was in the largest forensic psychiatric hospital. It was my first time too, and it was very interesting to be there, especially because now we have the show. So I have deliberately observed how the entrance was, what happened, how the guards were treating me, how the sphere was, and this might be interesting to share with you on this show now.
I'd like to hear it, and I know the audience would be very interested in hearing about the things that go on in there.
Yeah, because I think it's very important to see that here in the Netherlands we have these forensic psychiatric hospitals. We also have normal psychiatric hospitals. That's for people who suffer from a trauma or a psychiatric disorder. But forensic psychiatric hospitals are only for people who also suffer from a psychiatric disorder or trauma and have committed a crime. So in the Netherlands, when people commit a crime and they have this disorder, they do have to do a prison sentence, but we always strive to keep the prison sentence as short as possible, because prison time always leads to damage. We call it here detention damage. And what we see with people who commit a crime while they have a disorder, they do some time in prison, but the most time they are in a psychiatric hospital to get treatments, to get healed. That's a very important difference with the United States, because in the 60s in the United States, these hospitals have been closed. There was a financial depression in the whole of the country, and they tried to save money by closing these hospitals. So, and at that time, there was also the development of new medicine for all kinds of disorders. So people were sent on the streets with medicine, but they went to the cities, but the cities did not get money to help these people. So in the end, a lot of these people ended up in prison, and that's what you'll see also in current situation. So it's very sad that the vulnerable people are in that violent environment. Today, I was in the largest forensic psychiatric hospitals in hospital in the Netherlands. I only knew that hospital from television. You know, when there has been a very large crime and it's on television, then the people, the offender is going to that hospital to be examined and to get treatment. I must say there also were walls and there also were fences, because there are very dangerous people inside of there, but it's much more modern, so it's not scary. And I observed the guards this time very closely, and they were human. I don't feel the pressure, even while I had to go through all kinds of closed doors, like what is the same in the United States prison. So I had to go through all kinds of closed doors. I also had to go through that's a telephone.
If you want to take that, Marion, that's fine.
Hello. Please leave a message after
the call. Okay, I have put both on mute, so whoever is calling, you can feel free to respond. I wanted to say something with Marion Jacobs. She does a lot of work and research and her own philosophy on deeper justice. And one of the things involved, when you do something like that, and I want to say this because some people may think that some of the professional psychiatrists, psychologists, whatever, have more time on their hands to be able to do more for people in the public. And I know for myself, I am so busy because I have an organization and a radio show, but we also look at, I always look at people like Marion Jacobs, who have so many things they're doing. She's speaking about going into the penal system, going into these prisons, meeting, doing these lectures, doing these forensic clinics, and there's so much involved. And Miriam, I just want to say, I don't know how you find the time, but there's so many professionals out there, that are doing what you're doing, and I don't know how you do it. We have counselors, we have all kinds of therapists out there, life coach therapists, we have counselors in other areas, but they don't have that extensive work that they're doing, like you yourself. How do you do it?
Well, the things I do, they all are all connected to each other. Like the work that I do is also connected to my study philosophy. And now this summer I'm going to graduate from philosophy, but my thesis is also about the United States prison system. So that connects again also to my book. So it's one big picture, and that's why I also am able to go deeper into what is happening. And I do in fact have this one view, one vision, which I call deeper justice, and that's when in personal contact with the offender is meeting the human being behind the crime, and that's healing for that person. But that's also what I do to the system. When I write about the system, I look behind the system, what is happening. It's my way of meeting people, but also observing what is happening. So like what I now did today in the clinic is observing the guards, how they treat me, and thinking about, hey, what is the difference, what I experienced in the Florida prison system. And then I come to the conclusion that it's about a mindset. These guards do the same work as the guards in the United States. These guards don't abuse their power. They have the same position. They are also in a uniform, but they don't abuse it. They stay human towards me and towards the people who are incarcerated there. So I learned from that change you have to make in the United States, it's really a matter of changing the mindset. And that's the most difficult thing to do, but it can be done. So I do, the old things I do match each other.
Yeah, and I can see. I see how everything's connected. You know, when you talk about a lot of these things, how it's all connected.
Yes, and I think the approach of meeting the human being behind the crime, but that's also what I do with my own children. When I meet my children, I first meet human being behind my child, in fact. You know, if we live this way, then we have true connections behind the surface. And especially people inside the prison system need that, because nobody else treats them that way. The man I was visiting today, I am helping him since 2 years, so I know his background, and I'm not going to talk about it because it's private. But one of the last times that he called me, he said, oh, I have to move again to another system, but I'm glad that I can take you with me, because you are the one face that is familiar to me and goes with me to every time I have to be transferred. And that's so important, that you stay faithful, and whether you are, it doesn't matter in what role, whether you are a therapist or a coach or you are a pen pal or whatever, or a family member, the prisoner so much needs that one familiar face where he knows, okay, this face stays with me because I am so lost in that system. And I think that's very important for whatever you are or in whatever what role you play in the life of an offender, that he feels that you take him seriously, that you are faithful to him, that you're not abandoning him, and that you keep your promises to him. I think that's so, or to her, of course, that's so important. That's what I really want to pass through this message, because I hear it back from my own clients in prison.
I wanna as a social worker myself, I wanna expand a little bit on that, because in working with the incarcerated individuals that I've worked with and that my organization has worked with throughout these years, one of the things is prisoners, and I don't like to call them prisoners, so I will say incarcerated individuals, they don't have trust in anyone anymore, because they have been so manipulated by others and so they've gone through so much, many of them. And again, I'm not saying every prisoner is good, deserves to be free, but many of them do. But one of the things is, I always tell my volunteers, try to be personable when you're writing to these people. you know, call them by first names. And the reason I say this is because they feel they can trust you more. But the main thing is confidentiality. We have to always remember when we're working with any clients or when we're doing anything, as you mentioned, as you yourself, we have to maintain their trust in their what they are telling us, or even the names. We can't be putting their information out there like it's just another individual we're friends with. So I think attracting these prisoners to someone, you know, like they know can trust. I think that means a lot too, because they're more apt to open up about their life and the stumbling that they went through, or the offense, the crime that they've committed. I think once they know that they can trust, and I've had so many prisoners who in the beginning I had problems, you know, with as far as getting them to open up and really talk about the situations, because we hear from the media and we hear from others that are out in society about individuals that are incarcerated without having all the facts, without knowing anything about them or actually knowing the truth. So to get to the truth, I think that's a vital thing for many of us, to be able to let these people know, you can trust us. We're not here to judge you. You know, you can trust us. We're not here to expose your information or your name. So this is how a lot of clients that I've had in the organization, this is how a lot of them have been able to open up about the truth and what's going on in their lives prior to and after.
Yeah, I, and you know what, Leona, I think also that the choice to communicate with somebody in prison has to be a very conscious choice because this is very sensitive. Another thing is what I experienced myself is that it's important to stay as long as needed. So the processes that I have contact with somebody like this man today, I know him since 2 years, and that you know, because I take my time and I take for as long as needed, he has the time to learn to trust me, to experience that I don't run away or that I don't abandon him. Because, you know, before the most of these men have committed a crime, they already had issues with trust, responsibility, reliability. They have already been harmed in that. Inside the prison, it goes on. The harm, the pain goes on in the system in the United States. So they are extra vulnerable for that. The one who is connecting with the incarcerated man or woman, that he or she knows exactly what she's doing, not simply connect and then walk away. And it's easy to walk away because, you know, it's easy to make a promise to an incarcerated man or woman and not keep that promise, because no one is going to hold you accountable. The imprisoned man, he is incarcerated. He can go nowhere. He has not a position to complain or whatever. So he only is waiting for this contact. He is the vulnerable person. He is the humiliated person. So it's very easy to break promise, to make a promise and to break a promise. And so you have to be so conscious what you do and what you say. Don't make a promise if you can't keep it.
Exactly.
And that's you are very, very responsible. And that also has to do with moral responsibility, especially with this group of people, because they cannot just simply call you up and complain. They are only waiting. And I think when somebody chooses to work with these people, you really have to know what you are going to do. And you have to be very, very conscious. And then it's the most beautiful job to do, because you can contribute on a beautiful way to people. I enjoy it so much when I see that people, you know, start to trust me slowly, you know, show more about themselves. And with showing themselves to me, they also have the possibility to show their original who they are to themselves. You know, they get to know themselves better. They also get to know the person behind the crime. They were before everything happened. It's growing towards somebody's own authenticity. And that goes with tiny steps, but every tiny step is a beautiful step to see, and it leads to liberation inside themselves. So it's very rewarding to do it. It's very rewarding. But you have to know what you do. You have to be very conscious in what you do, because harm is done very quickly if you are not serious, if you are not conscious of the group, these people and their vulnerability.
You know, one of the things that I find sad too is that there are so many people on the outside that have issues as well, and unfortunately they don't get caught. And I mean, this is the problem, because we live in a society that thinks that they are really the righteous ones. And we've had a caller in the past that come on a couple of times to talk about that. They don't think that they are considered offenders, but they're offenders just basically in ignoring the fact that there are victims that are incarcerated and focusing on the fact that there are victims on the outside. I always bring this up because it's very important to know, and that's why I always talk about replacing prisons with long-term residential treatment facilities. Mm-hmm. We have to realize prisoners, I say it all the time, they should not be stereotyped. You know, they should not be, because there are so many different situations. And when you talk about deeper justice, and you talk about really looking into the causes of crime and not so much the crime itself, if we looked into the crimes, there's so many different types of crimes. There are crimes where people have been burned alive. They have been scalded alive. There have been crimes of people that have been put to death and executed on death row. There are prisoners who have been beaten terribly to death. There have been people that have been shot. There's so many different situations. But we have to look at the causes behind a lot of these things, and we have to look at the past, what they were like before, the offenders. Were they psychologically disturbed seriously before? Did somebody cause them to stumble? Did they have a breakdown? I mean, so many different situations.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that we should stop judging people in society and also the people in the prisons, because, you know, nobody knows who is what a bad person is or what a good person is. We know what bad acts are and good acts are. We can judge and we can condemn the crime, but that's somebody else, something else than judging the person. You know, there is a difference between judging the person and judging the crime. Of course, if I harm somebody else, then I am going to be convicted and I end up in prison. But it's the crime that has to be judged, not me. So time in prison should be used for rehabilitation. Taking away the time, that's the payment that somebody does. That's here in the Netherlands. You do time, and with that you pay back for the crime you committed. But in the meanwhile, while you are giving up that part of time that you do in prison, you should have the possibility to rehabilitate, because that's in the benefit not only for the incarcerated people, but also for society. What you see now, that society maintains dangerous because people don't learn anything in prison. It's even worse. They learn how to become more violent even. They are lucky when they survive the system. And then they get hit the streets. And how are they supposed to adapt to society when they have been in a devastating and violent environment for so long? You can't expect somebody to adapt and to function in society when he comes from that awful prison. That's that's almost impossible. And the endless revenge and retaliation leads to nowhere, leads to nowhere. We are not allowed to judge another person. We only can judge acts, but never the person. We can't. We don't know what a good or a bad person is. If you ask 10 people, what does good mean? Then you get 10 all kinds of different answers. These terms are empty, and it's only the perspective what we have. We only have our own perspectives. We don't have, there is no truth in that. And that's,
you know,
yes.
No, go ahead, please finish.
Well, I think that that's an important part for society to become aware of. We don't need to forget the crime. If I work with the people here at prison, I don't act as if they are only a victim of the system. They also have committed a crime and they are responsible. But I have to learn, help them to become aware of their responsibility. They have to learn what is responsibility. They have to become able to learn to act responsible. But what you see in United States society is when they simply lock up the people, then the society also do not take responsibility. So who is responsible then? Nobody takes responsibility. And the offender, you know, before he committed the crime, and I'm not saying it's always that way, but many times, there were issues with responsibility, because if he didn't have issues with responsibility, he would not have committed the crime. So something has gone wrong in his life. Most of the time, it has gone wrong in his youth. It can be a trauma. It can be a disorder or whatever. That has to be discovered when you are examining people. So before he committed the crime, he did not develop a healthy way of responsibility. So he could commit crime, but then he goes into prison, and into prison, all his responsibilities are taken away from him. So he has no ability to develop it in while he is doing time. And after the prison, he gets released, and he still doesn't know how to behave like a responsible person. So he remains. He remains a danger because he doesn't know, he has not become aware of taking responsibility and act on a responsible way. So that's why you see this circle. It's a devastating circle of violence and lack of responsibility, because the prison system also does not act responsible. That's why you have all this violence and abuse of power. Society does also not take responsibility because they say, lock them all up. Politics does also not take responsibility because they closed the psychiatric hospitals and they have not opened them yet. And when you look at economics, corporations are involved in mass incarceration, and they are by law not responsible for the well-being of the prisoners. They are only responsible for their own stockholders. So if you put all these fields in a line, and they are all connected to mass incarceration, then I come to the conclusion that nobody takes any responsibility, and that means that prisoners are outlawed. Who are these prisoners? He is not allowed to be responsible, and nobody takes responsibility for them. That's like the people in the concentration camps. And that's what we have to become aware of, because this is huge. How is it possible in a democracy, in a country that sees itself as a role model for the world, that it treats their own citizens as outlawed people? That's true dehumanization.
You know, and I break it down to a lot of times. First of all, you mentioned retaliation. I look at so many cases, many are worse than others, and yet the ones that are worse, a lot of times the victim or the victim's family will say, okay, they arrested him, he's serving life without parole, he's on death row, whatever the case may be, that's it. They're satisfied that justice was served. Then you have families and whose situation's pretty much the same, but maybe less traumatic, I don't know. But those are the ones that even beyond the offender going to extreme sentencing or death row, they still want more. They want to do as much as they can to bring on more pain and sorrow and suffering. And what happens in cases like that, many of them, we have in the prisons, we have many overseers who are just as criminal-like who will do the same thing. They're not satisfied with the fact that these people are incarcerated and are going to be incarcerated for the rest of their life or eventually being put to death, but they want to make their lives miserable in the process. Then we and this is sad because this should not be, but it gives you an idea or gives me an idea of what the victim or the victim's family was about prior to as well. So these are my thoughts on that one.
Yeah, what you now see is an endless circle of violence, retaliation, and revenge. And the thing is, I've mentioned that before, the process that a victim has to go through is another process than where the offender has to go through. Those, you can't compare them. They are, of course, both two parties of the same crime. They are related to the same crime. But their processes are different. And for the victim, it's very difficult, of course, to go through that process of healing because he is the one who has been harmed. But in the case somebody has been killed, you can't bring that person back to life. And it is sad, and that's why the prisoners, the offender has to do time. He has to pay off for what he did. But for the victim, I also have worked with victims for a few years. So it was me very important to see that part too. What I saw in my own experience with victims was that at some point they had to choose to come to healing for themselves. Otherwise, they had a choice, staying stuck in retaliation and revenge, which leads to a life full of bitterness, or the other path, go through that process of healing and find peace inside. And it's a very difficult process. But they have no other choice because you can't turn the crime back. And then you get to the path of restorative justice. But that's afterwards. Both victim and offender first have to do an individual process of what I call deeper justice. The processes are different, and only after the offender has come to insight in himself, but also in his crime, because denying the crime is harmful. So he has to learn to face the crime that he has committed. Come to development of responsibility, that he can feel that he has been responsible for that crime that he has committed, that he also can feel guilty, because guilty also leads to healing, because then he can come to closure. At the same time, there is the victim who has to go through his or her own process of healing, and only after that there can be true restorative, pure restorative justice, where the victim and the offender meet, and the offender can say from his heart that he is guilty because he has gone through that process, and that the victim can might be able to forgive because she or he has gone through that process. Forgiveness is always a possible outcome of a process of healing. It's not an act that you can plan. It's something that might come out of a process of healing. And if it's not, then it's okay too. But the processes are very important. It's always about the path. It's not about the end of the path, but it's about experiencing, going through that process. Only that is the answer to healing, to getting the number of recidivism lower. It's the answer to humanity, and it's the answer to civilization. What happens now is in the United States, it's a democracy. It calls itself a civilization, but this whole mass incarceration is really barbaric. That has nothing to do with civilization. And we have to be aware of that. We are never, ever allowed to dehumanize another person. Not ever. If another person is, even if he is a serious serial killer or whatever, if I am a civilized person, then I will always keep my dignity and I will always treat the other person from my own dignity. And if I am able to dehumanize the other person, then I first have dehumanized myself.
You know what I've had the experience of with relatives of victims talking about how their family was divided because they broke apart because one member of the family or some members of a family may have forgiven or may have been understanding of the offense or whatever and have been willing to forgive, and while others aren't. This is where we come into play with the people on the outside that have no knowledge of the families other than the person that was harmed and the person that was sent to prison. A lot of times people out in society, they don't realize that families that have been victimized or a loved one of a family that had been victimized, they're struggling and they're trying to, at least some of them in some cases, they're struggling to try to understand and to try to forgive. Well, these are families that are being divided because of the two. My mother used to always say there's no two people alike in any household. Everybody's different. And I think this happens in situations like this too. However, when the media is continuously talking about it, reporting all of these things and getting in the middle, because the media is supposed to be neutral. I remember years ago, they used to report news. They used to report, sports was a different issue. There was a different station for sports. There was a different station for other talks. In this day and age, all the news is combined in one, and it's all garbage. A lot of it is garbage. And then you have the media, the reporters, getting in, instead of staying neutral, getting in the middle of it. So these things here do not help. It doesn't help to heal at all. But I wanted to say that because we have too many people that are under the assumption that everybody in families of victims are all as evil or hateful or retaliative as some. And this is not the case. There are good people on both sides of the fence. And I think sometimes family members of the victim see something good in a person, even though that person has committed an offense. And they also hear in court what led to that offense. And I think they think about these things because, as I say, there are people who have been traumatized in prison prior to the crime. They were wrongfully convicted. There were first-time offenders. There were so many different situations.
Yeah, I think what's important, if you go deeper, what I call deeper justice. If you go deeper in the justice, then it's even impossible to judge anymore. You can't judge anymore because, you know, nobody is born bad. Nobody. So something on the road went differently and went wrong. Even if you know, there was such an important case for me to read about. Just before Trump finished his term, left the office, he had all these the death penalties. You know, he approved with about 5, 6, or 7 death penalties. And one was this woman. And this woman was on death row and she had committed such a heinous crime. She killed that pregnant woman and she cut the baby out of the belly of the woman and she took the baby with her. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, and that's so important, you know, that's such an important lesson. First, I only read about the crime. So I saw her picture and I read about crime and it shocked me because, you know, I have been pregnant 4 times. I have 4 children. So, and it was like a thriller, you know. But later on, and I had I wanted to judge her. I wanted to condemn her. Oh, that's an evil woman because she has committed this heinous crime. But a few days later, I read about the life of that woman, who was in death row, you know, the offender, and how heinous her own life has been, that she has been raped by her stepfather, that her parents even had a room in their house where her stepfather and all the friends of her stepfather could sexually abuse her. What I read there, what she has been through in her life, as heinous as the crime that she had committed. And when I read about her background, her evil background, what she has been through as a little girl, who am I to judge that woman? She should have even while the crime was so heinous, I thought I wish she could have been locked up for the rest of her life, but in a psychiatric hospital with decent guards, decent personal staff who are human to her, you know, in her daily life, because she has never, ever felt any humanity in her whole life. Who am I to judge this, you know? So I, of course, judge the crime, but I cannot judge that person. How would I have been if I would have stood in her shoes? I would maybe have committed the same crime.
It's so sad.
But that's why we can never, ever, we are not allowed to condemn human life. And if you are religious, we are all created by God. If I judge another life, then I also condemn God, because God created that life. There is a divine, but that's my own belief, there is a divine part in every human being that I am not allowed to judge, because that's not me. I am not God. I'm not going to stand in the shoes of divinity. But that's for me personal. And besides my religious part, I feel so intense that I am not allowed to judge a human being. I am only allowed to judge the crime, but not the human being.
That's it. And it says that in the Bible too. And I'm not afraid to say that, but it says in the Bible, we need to worry about ourselves, because we're going to be judged too. And if we're too busy focusing on others to judge them, then we're in big trouble ourselves, because like I say, no one in this world is perfect. No one can say they're perfect.
No, and I don't think we should be perfect because we learn from our mistakes. And of course, the people, and of course, there is a difference. But the people who are in prison, they made a mistake that was harming society. That's why they are in prison, of course. But and I don't close my eyes for that. But give them the possibility to learn from their mistakes. I see it this way: a prisoner has the ability to go through rehabilitation, also for society, for himself, but also for society.
And I don't know why society does not want to see these people going into residential facilities for treatments with professionals and experienced psychiatrists and psychologists.
Well, I think that has to do with that judgment, what we're talking about. They judge, they condemn the people who commit crimes, and they condemn them blindly without looking beyond the crime. And they don't want to spend the money. You know, we pay more taxes here because we have these clinics. That's a choice we make as a society. But it's, you know, what you see now in the United States prisons, why it's a mass incarceration, because drug addicts or other addicts, people with disorders, trauma, and people who have committed a crime without a disorder, everybody, you know, I call it the melting pot of undesirables. Oh, and there are a lot of people incarcerated who stand for minorities, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like the people in prison are incarcerated because they stand in the way of the wealthy ones. You know, they cost too much money. So throw them in the system. It's crazy to think that if I have committed a crime, or maybe I have committed a crime, then I have to do a plea bargain. I even cannot go to court. I have to do a plea bargain. That's negotiation about the crime and the time. That has nothing to do with nothing to do with judgment. That has to do with money. If I pay money, I get less time. If I don't do a plea bargain, I can go to court, but then I might face a life sentence or whatever.
That's not judging.
That has nothing to do with judgment. That has to do with money.
And that's what it's all about. Greed. We have a government that's full of greed. Government officials that are looking at the monies that they're making. And there's a lot of celebrities out there. There's a lot of people out there that have investments in the prison system. And they're making money every time that prison is full, which they're trying to keep it full. They're making money in the Department of Corrections across the country. They're making money on these prisoners too, because everything that is being done now is through their contracted agencies or through them. And again, with Securus, that's one of the contracted agencies. Hmm. With Securus, they charge, I noticed they have different ID, prison ID numbers for the people that are on their payroll. I mean, for the people that are going to them for services. They have different ID numbers. And I asked them one time why their ID numbers were different than the ID numbers in the prisons themselves. And they said the Department of Correction officials, that's the way they wanted it to be done. So I wonder why the Department of Corrections officials would be having two separate ID numbers on the incarcerated men and women, unless they're doing something underhandedly and they don't want the prisoners, they don't want the information to get out that they're making more money from what they're doing using different ID numbers for the incarcerated that they already have ID numbers on. So where do these two ID numbers come from? And is it just Securus, or is it other contracted agencies around the country with the Department of Corrections?
Yeah, I also think that it's a part of the bureaucracy. You know, the whole bureaucracy, around the system is one big twilight zone, and that keeps mass incarceration going too. Where you see that prisoners do have rights, the prison rights inside the system, but at the same time, you know, when they want to complain, they have to go through endless procedures until they give up. So what you see is legally, it seems that they have rights, but when you look at practice, their voice is not heard. And that's, I think, a very important part of the power of the correctional institutions. You know, they have no right to vote. It's taken away from them. So in society, they are less than human. They are not longer a part of the political society, the good life where we live in. So that's a piece of dehumanization. Inside the prison system, it seems that they have rights. You see, legally they have rights. But the procedures have been made so difficult that they almost give up in the end with their complaints. Or if they try to complain, then there is revenge of the staff. You see the game? Do you see the game?
Yes.
The prison game. That's very important because that's part of dehumanization if you take away the rights. But the game is that on the outside, on the surface, politicians could say, yeah, but our prisoners have rights. There are the prison rights. We have 8th Amendment. We have 14th Amendment. But why, if we have all these rights? Why, if we have 8th Amendment? Why, if we have 14th Amendment? Is it possible that people get tortured, that people get tortured to death without any systemic change? Because it goes on and on. And that's because the whole bureaucracy is one big twilight zone. So nobody knows exactly what is happening. And what you always say, Leona, there's no oversight. So anybody can do, you know, so who is going to hold them accountable for what they do? And then we get back to what we start this conversation with, responsibility. Who is responsible for the life, the human beings in the system? Nobody. That's only for the public. There is responsibility. But if you look deeper, and that's what I mean with when I write about the deep patterns of the system, if you look deeper, nobody takes responsibility. Because if they would, the whole system would not exist in the way it does now. There would not be this violence. You know, there would not be rape of women, killing people in prison, feeding them with food with maggots in it. We have countless examples.
Yes.
Everybody knows what's going on. Facebook is full of it. Still, it's going on. And that's because of there is no transparency. There is no really responsibility. It's only for the public. On the outside, you know, if you look at correctional institutions, the word correctional means rehabilitation. So to the public, to society, it's sold as a picture of prisoners who get rehabilitated inside the system. But we all know that inside the system, they are lost and they get broken. And that's the political game that is played. And that's what people have to become aware of. Because the society also gets a false picture. They pay a lot of tax money for prisons, but their tax money is not going to prisoners, it's going to corporations.
Exactly. You know, I want to say too, when you talk about, I was going to say there's good and bad in people in all areas, and this is an example. We have judges who are fair, and they are going to go by the rules. Then we have other judges that not. And just before coming on the show today, I don't know if you heard about that other, there was another black shooting, black man in North Carolina that was shot in the 20 seconds of the video was released to the family and the family's lawyer. 20 seconds. So it's been all over CNN and everything. They're wondering where is the rest of it, and they're talking about having that video released. Now, earlier, before coming on the show, I noticed that the judge that they were trying to get to have the video released, the judge denied it. So why would a judge deny something that's so obvious there's something behind it all, 20 seconds of a video where a man was shot in the back of his head while his hands were on the steering wheel in his vehicle? This is a clear example of the differences in the justice system. We have corrupt judges. We have corrupt lawyers. We have honest judges. We have honest lawyers. We have good correctional officers. We have corrupt. This is every single area that we're talking about today, even with advocates. We have advocates that want to join forces and come together to get rid of the injustice. And then we have advocates that are either jealous of someone else because that person is not their friend, or because they're jealous of someone else because that person has a bigger organization, or because that there's so many different reasons why advocates don't even come together. So we have good advocates out there and we have bad advocates. We have some advocates that will try to cause problems for another advocate. Then we have advocates that are looking. There's coalitions in Massachusetts that I belong to. There's several of them. And there are a lot of them coming together to address the issues of abolishment of life without parole, to abolish restrictive housing units, to abolish solitary confinement. There's all these different groups coming together, but yet they're not coming together as one whole group, which means they're not all coming together, which means that these coalitions are very small, where they could be a lot bigger. They could draw in a lot more attention, and they're all focusing on similar issues. I don't understand it. But again, I can't be involved in all of them because I'm trying to run an organization and a radio show to bring the awareness. Some of these coalitions are trying to brainstorm to find out ways that they can bring all of this to the public's awareness, that they can expose. And yet there's people out there that have radio shows, not just myself, but there are so many people that have radio shows pertaining to the injustices in the penal system, things that are going on in the country, and also people who have committed suicide, people who have been in solitary for years. These things are all things that need to come about. But these organizations who claim to be advocates for the incarcerated do not seem to come together.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are always all big egos everywhere, you know, people who do it for their own ego. And when you talk about the system, of course, you have good advocates, bad advocates, you have good guards, bad guards. But the thing is, the system itself is rotten. The system itself, how it functions. And because there is no oversight, if you would have oversight, you know, what you mentioned yourself a couple of times, and if there is no transparency, then you cannot say, okay, this is a good one, he can stay, and that's a dysfunctional one, he has to leave. Normally in an organization, you know, I started my new job. If in a month I'm not functional, then I lose my job. Simple as that. But in the system, people cover each other because, of course, there's also a lot of money involved. And there are some figures who don't want change in that system.
I believe,
you know,
it.
And the system itself is wrong. It's not people, but it's the system, how it functions, that it's not transparent. You know, when things sometimes come to the surface, like somebody is beaten to death in prison or whatever, and a guard is involved, and then he gets he's sued. And the family gets an amount of money. That's always sued on a personal level. They do that way to keep the family quiet, you know, with a lawsuit. And they can say to the public, see, we take our responsibility because there was a lawsuit, or we paid the family for what that guard has done, and maybe that guard loses a job. But they never make a systemic change. They don't learn from it because it's cheaper and it's easier to pay one family than to make a change nationwide. You know, so how many times have there been lawsuits that families have been paid, but that's all on individual level. like what you see now with George Floyd, this man gets 40 years, or I don't know how many years he gets, Gauguin, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, that police officer who is now on trial. But that's an individual case.
That was Chauvin?
So it's an individual case, and he's going to be held responsible now, and he gets a sentence. I don't know for how long, but he will be sentenced. But I wonder, is this now going to change the whole police department?
And
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think so, indeed, because they, you know, that's another political game. So for the public, they can show politics can show that they are doing something, that they are holding someone accountable by doing this lawsuit, etc. But they do nothing on systemic level. And if you want to change the system, well, the word is there. If you want to change mass incarceration, then it has to be made on systemic level. It's a mindset, and it starts with politics.
You know what? I actually want to see, you know, because I get so tired of hearing them say, like, police training. It has nothing to do with the training. It has to do with the racism in America, and it has to do with, again, the power and the greed. And going back to advocates, even with advocates, we see too many cliques in this country. Now, cliques went out the door when I graduated from high school, as far as I'm concerned. But when we have adults and we have professionals and we have coalitions and we have even single advocates that have to feel like they need to have their fellow advocates, their friends. We don't have to be friends with anybody. All we need to do is keep our focus on the cause. And we have too many people in this country that are in these coalitions, that are in these organizations, that are out there talking about trying to do the same thing to resolve these issues of injustices in the penal system. But yet they want to be friends. If they can't be a friend of their fellow advocate, something is definitely wrong. They don't take into consideration some advocates are working harder than them. Some advocates are out there doing more research. Some advocates are out there trying to actually help the incarcerated, not just help the cause, but actually help the incarcerated. We have ACLU that always gives the excuse when they don't help these incarcerated. They always give the excuse they don't have the resources or the manpower. Prison and legal services, the same thing. They don't have the manpower or the funds or the resources. But yet they're getting their names out there in the media. They're getting involved in all these coalitions just to get their names out there. What are they actually doing for those who are suffering behind those prison walls?
Yeah.
So we have too many cliques in this country, people that forget to grow up once they graduate from high school, and they want to associate with just the people that they feel are out there that have that name. And unfortunately, the names out there of these organizations and these law firms does not necessarily mean they're actually doing anything, but it would mean the receptionists are always ready to answer the phone.
But then it has more to do with status and a big ego, positions of power.
Yeah, they need to be more honest about what they're actually doing and not what their name is showing.
Exactly, because, you know, everybody has the same goal, and that's changing mass incarceration, and somebody emphasizes the prisoners, otherwise other people emphasize the system. But it's all the same. It should all be the same about the same issue, and that's mass incarceration, ending mass incarceration.
Yes.
That's the main goal. I mean, but you always have egos who only do that because they want to be interesting, and they want to have the status, and they want to have the titles and all that. And, well, that's what you also see in society, of course, because, you know, the whole mass incarceration problem starts in society. It doesn't start in the prison. It starts in society. Society created the system. Every system that is developed by human beings is also a mirror of society, because human beings created mass incarceration. So it's telling something about the people who created it, and that's we are human beings. We are able, capable of creating it. And mass incarceration is a part of society. They can build all these huge warehouses far away from society, but they are still a part of society. And they always will be. And the 2.2 million people behind bars are all people, are all Americans, are all inhabitants of the United States, whether people like it or not. And what you say about majority means if somebody is mature, it means that he takes responsibility. And if a country is not able or does not want to take responsibility for its citizens behind the wall, then you can say the whole country is immature. And that's something to say.
I've actually seen on websites, though, with law firms and people that do civil rights, when they say that they don't have the manpower or the resources at a particular time, they also have on their website, you know, this area of the organization is temporarily closed because we do not have the manpower or the funding or whatever it may be. They put it out there that they can't take any more cases. But when you have these law firms that say they can't take any more cases, and yet there's nothing on the website that says they're not taking any more cases, or there's nothing that says that they don't have the resources, this is something questionable.
Yeah, and it's also, again, a lack of transparency. You know, I think be always clear in your message. If you can take clients, then be transparent. And if you can't, then be transparent too. And that's the whole problem. There is so less transparency. Transparency.
Exactly. I think overseeing should be done in all areas of organizations as well as the penal system. Oversight is very, years ago when I first started the organization and we were doing national at the time, everything I did, I sent it out to everybody, all my volunteers, everybody in the organization, plus advocates, everything. And I wanted to be transparent about everything that was going on. Because mm-hmm. if you cannot be transparent about what you're doing and there's no oversight from independent overseers on the outside, anybody can get away with anything. And this
Exactly. And then you miss responsibility. And that's because then you act the same as what the prison system does.
Exactly. So we have good and bad all over the place. And that's mass incarceration, a result of mass incarceration.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, we have good and bad everywhere in every organization. But for as long as there is overseas and people can be held accountable, then, you know, then you can deal with it. But if nobody is responsible and if there is no transparency, then you cannot hold people accountable. And then you get in this twilight zone of, you know, everybody can do what he wants to do. And then it becomes dangerous. And that's exactly what you see in the prison system. That's wrong in the prison system. That's why all these crazy things can happen.
Yeah, so much corruption around the whole country. So much corruption.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it has to do with maturity. You know, if you are a responsible person and you can be held accountable, that means that you are mature.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, that's a big problem. That's a really big problem also in society. What they try to do is, you know, like on the street with the militarized police, you know, it's all trying to, it's a matter of trying to keep people in control. But if you keep people in control, then they cannot be responsible for themselves. Then you keep them like little children.
Sure. Yes. You know, we actually have an incarcerated individual calling in from Pennsylvania, and I don't know if he wants to say a few things on the radio show, but his name is Kelly. And Kelly, would you like to say anything? We have Maryam Jacobs on the radio with us t- today from the Netherlands, and Miriam is a psychosocial therapist, and she talks about the causes of crime. Her focus is deeper justice, looking into the causes of crime and not the individual or the crime itself. Do you want to, you have anything you want to say while you're with us?
Hello, Miriam.
Hello.
And I definitely agree with what you looked into. That theory would hold a lot of weight with a lot of people if they would just pay attention to what's really going on in this world. Now, you're saying, you can't just look at the crime. Sometimes the circumstances have something to do with it. You know, how did that situation even come about? Because some things are circumstantial. I've been in a few situations like that myself. And, you know, continued incarceration doesn't really help anybody. Not that I know of. All board does is teach you how to lie. Pretend that you got remorse. Sometimes people don't have remorse for things that they've done. You know, they did what they did because that's what they felt that they had to do. And you can't force somebody into having remorse for something. So, you know, that's teaching them how to lie, how to get around the system. You're not really fixing whatever the problem is. You're just creating a bigger problem on a larger scale. So, you know.
I wanted to real quickly say, in Miriam and I have been talking on the radio about the different situations, how prisoners should not be stereotyped. And I wanted to, if you don't mind, Samson, I wanted to bring up the fact that Samson's situation has been very difficult for him throughout the years because he lost his father through suicide, he lost his brother through suicide, and then his mother recently passed a few years ago from cancer. So, Kelly, do you want to talk about some of the things that you've been through and what's been going on with you?
Well, exactly what do you mean by what I've been going through? Because you pretty much just said it right there.
Well, your mother left a house for you in North Carolina, and Kelly got out a few years ago. Tell the audience about that situation.
Yeah, well, my mother died. She died intestate. So she didn't have a will, supposedly didn't have a will. So I ended up inheriting half the house. My two nephews and my niece are supposed to inherit the other half. But so I was stuck in a situation where I was in prison. I couldn't get out. I couldn't do anything about it. So my sister-in-law took it upon herself to go ahead and just pretty much rob the house. She took everything there was of value in the house, destroyed my mother's car, busted all the windows out, kicked the doors in, whatever. You know, pretty much.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Brackville.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
A couple of doors, toilets, and so on and so forth. That's the house that's repaired. So I had to put in an interstate transfer to try to, whenever I finally did make parole, to try to get out of it because I didn't have nowhere to go whenever I first made parole. So it took 2 years and 4 months before I could finally get out. And the only reason that I did get out was because this lovely lady that you're hosting your radio show right now took it upon herself to rent me a place whenever, you know, that was approved by parole so I could get out. That was back in 2016.
I didn't rent it. I contacted somebody that was renting in Pennsylvania.
That's exactly. If it wasn't for that, I'd have probably never got out and still been in the same situation as I'm in now. Well, anyhow, I did get out, and I was working. I was doing pretty good, and I had an interstate transfer in. I had to pay $120 to do that. They never did look into whatever it was they were supposed to look into. I know they were supposed to contact the parole board down there, their parole officers or somebody. I called North Carolina Parole myself, talked to them. They said all they were waiting on was Pennsylvania to get a hold of them, you know, do some fine-tuning on the paperwork. Because they got what I sent into them. So they never did contact me. So I don't even know if I still have the house. I probably lost it. I don't know. But it's been, eight years now. What is it? Yeah, 2021. Yeah, it's been 8 years that the house has been sitting down there pretty much empty and in disrepair. So I'm stuck up here in Pennsylvania. Like Neona said, my dad committed suicide. My brother committed suicide. My grandma's, they're both deceased. I had a cousin that committed suicide and a good friend of mine. It's like everybody's dropping like flies. So I'm left stuck in prison up here in Pennsylvania and don't have any family.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Brackville.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
So my only contact with the outside world is, you know, Fiona and, you know, Angie every now and again whenever I get a hold of her. And that's pretty much it.
Well, the audience will be hearing you. We have 6,000 something listening, so I'm sure that. But what I was going to say, my reason for asking Samson Kelly to talk about this is because he had an opportunity to go down to North Carolina, inherit his, and take over his mother's house, but because of the system and the games they play in preventing him from leaving through an interstate transfer. That time he was waiting, it ended up causing him probably to lose the house that he would have been able to have gotten his life together. Samson's incarceration was Samson's incarceration was a substance abuse related issue which happened years ago. But this is why Marianne and I were talking too about the replacing prisons with long-term residential treatment facilities. And Samson's case would have been a perfect example because it was a substance abuse related offense. And if we had the proper substance abuse treatment available to him and so many thousands of other prisoners, and at any point in time, that would be something that we would not be dealing with today, is mass incarceration, as you mentioned, Mariam, about mass incarceration for crimes that really do not, they need to be rehabilitated, not be retaliated against. Do you have anything?
Yes, and what I want to say, because I also heard the word that sometimes, you know, prisoners don't feel remorse. We have also life sentence in the Netherlands, but people get sentenced to a life sentence when they are not able or they don't want to become rehabilitated, or they cannot be rehabilitated, where they maintain a danger for society or themselves, then the decision might be made that he has to be locked up, stay away from the streets. But then the sentence is not connected to revenge and retaliation, but then it's connected to the personal situation of the individual who has gone through a process and has been examined. That's another attention, you know, that's another intention of giving somebody a life sentence. That's some, you see, so that's a big difference.
Well, Samson's case was, he was released, as he said, a few years back, and apparently went in, back in again because of some alcohol problem then. But these are the things that need to be resolved. And as you say, Mariam, there's so many reasons why people are incarcerated. In a situation like this, there's no need for this individual to be incarcerated. He needed to be in a long-term residential substance abuse treatment, and this is what's lacking in this country, are these programs that are not working on the outside, and that the institutions that have been closed down, and everyone is thrown into prison, as you say, and the keys are thrown away, and they're locked in for a long time. With Kelly, his time is, I think, 4 or 5 years. Did you get, Kelly?
Well, what you're talking about, whenever I got my violation, is actually didn't have anything to do with me drinking. It was somebody that I was with that got in an argument with somebody else. Whenever the cops showed up, because I was the one that had the record, I ended up getting arrested. So that's what happened with that right there.
Okay, so it was a kind of parole violation because being involved with somebody or being with someone that had a problem.
Right.
Well,
it's like double, quadruple jeopardy because they're arresting me because I have a past history of violence, and I have a past history of drug and alcohol abuse, so on and so forth. I'm the easy pickings. So it's easier to arrest me, charge me, and convict me than it would be somebody that never even had a record in the first place. So then they're getting their quota, they're getting their jollies, or whatever the case may be. That's how that went down. You know, like I said, I was working. I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, and it doesn't seem to be working to do what you're supposed to do. I know people that get out there, they're robbing people, they're selling drugs, they're doing drugs, and they're still out there. They leave them people alone. But whenever you go out there, you're actually trying to do the right thing. You got your own police, you're paying rent, you're trying to get a driver's license. That's another thing that kept me from getting my driver's license, which is really essential if you want to be able to get back and forth to work and do the things that you want to do. And everything they did was to deter you from even wanting to be out there in the first place. So, you know, eventually you just get the, hey, you know what, I'm just tired of this, I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. Then, you know, people go back to the bottle, people go back to the drugs, people go back to doing whatever it is they want to do because they see that whatever they're doing doesn't make a difference.
Exactly. Mariam is a psychosocial therapist. She's been in the prisons in the United States, and she also has been going into the prisons in the Netherlands. She's been speaking about the clinical. And Mariam, do you have anything to respond to what Kelly was just saying?
Yeah, well, the feeling I get, what I experience, I picture it, on that what I feel is that the society is so controlling, and the police, you know, it's like the police is the enemy, and you know, we can't behave perfect all the time. We can't behave right all the time, you know. But that's the way it feels, you know, as if in the United States or in some areas, I don't know, that you have to behave perfectly. Otherwise, because there is so much control on the streets, and it's like the prison system is an extension of what's happening on the streets. The control, if you are good or you are bad, that judgment. If you don't behave, then the police comes and the police is able to shoot you. You know, it sounds fearful. It sounds suppressing. The same suppression, what I see in the system, it's like I see that back in the streets, in personal lives. And that's so saddening, you know.
Well, you know, again, I'll say this, and we have about 3 minutes left, but I wanted to say real quickly, Mariam, what you were saying, the way the prison system is in the Netherlands, and Franz Kurz from Germany said the same thing, it's so different than mass incarceration in the United States, and Norway being the perfect one. This country needs to start going to do more research and going to those countries, your country included, and try to find a way to resolve these issues that are going up, because it's not getting any better in this country. It's getting worse. And the mass incarceration is not decreasing. As you know, Mariam, it's getting worse. And we need to do something about it. So I'm hoping that you will be able to influence the audience as they listen in right now. But real quickly, can you just talk about your book? Because we only have a few minutes left, and I'd like to get the information out, how people can contact you and how they can learn about your book, which is to be published very soon.
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn with my name, Mariam Jacobs. I'm on Facebook. I also have a Facebook page. It's called Deeper Justice. My email is mariamjacobs@gmail.com. mariamjacobs67@gmail.com. I'm writing my book. It's called Lost in the System, and it's about the deeper patterns that lay beneath how the system works. So it gives answers to questions that live in society, and the issues are not new, they are well known, but I connect them and I make a puzzle complete, and I hope to bring more awareness about how it's possible that we have a totalitarian prison system in a democracy.
And you can find Mariam Jacobs on the internet under Mariam Jacobs.
I have a website, www.deeperjustice.com.
And deeper justice is just what you do a lot of research on. Mariam, I want to thank you for coming on. Mariam Jacobs is on with us every Wednesday. Normally at 9 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, 3 o'clock her time. We have Mariam Jacobs on with us every Wednesday at 9 o'clock Eastern time. I hope you'll all come join in on the conversation, the discussions that she presents. Mariam Jacobs is well known. She's well known throughout the country now and in parts of the other countries. I want to thank you, Mariam, for being our guest every Wednesday. I want to thank you for coming on this afternoon, which is evening at your time. And I want to thank you so much.
Thank you, too. Thank you very much, too, Leona. You know that I enjoy to do this.
What was that, Samson? I'm sorry.
I said I thank her for fighting the good fight. You, too.
Kelly said he's thanking you for fighting the good fight, because, Mariam, we need more people in this country to be doing exactly what you're doing and others are doing from other countries for the United States prisoners. So I thank
you.
I thank you for being on with us, and
thank
I hope
you for using
everyone
is. Goodbye.
Thank you too.
I hope everybody in the audience will have
I wanted to thank Kelly. I wanted to say to, his name was Kelly. I wanted to say, nice to meet you. But then, you know, that's Securus, huh? The control of Securus. Oh,
yeah, really. Kelly is, and I'll tell you, I've known Kelly for some time. We actually did try to help him as well. And unfortunately now, I'm just focusing on Massachusetts because the problems in Massachusetts are just as bad and need to be resolved. But I just wanted to thank everyone for being on with us. Again, Maryam, thank you so, so much for being with us. And please join us next week, next Wednesday, 9 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time with Maryam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist. And also, her Facebook, again, is on her Deeper Justice is on Facebook. Thank you so much, Maryam. I really appreciate this once again.
Thank you, too. It was nice to be here. And we'll hear until next week.
Until next week. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.